Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 17, 2015. The U.S. State Department announces it is lifting sanctions on certain items headed to Sudan.
Department of Treasury and Department of Commerce have amended their regulations to authorize the export and re-export of certain personal communications, hardware, and software, as well as related services, from the United States or by U.S. persons to Sudan.
And a top South Sudanese official says there is no money for parliamentary activities.
We are not operating well because of lack of resources. Salaries is given and other things, very petty, are being carried out. But we have a lot of challenges.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Department of Commerce and Treasury is lifting a ban on individuals who want to export telecommunication equipment to Sudan. The move was announced today by the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. Ambassador Donald Booth told reporters via a telephone conference that the new move, to go into effect tomorrow, is in the best interest of both Sudanese and American business companies.
The Department of Treasury and Department of Commerce have amended their regulations to authorize the export and re-export of certain personal communications, hardware, and software, as well as related services, from the United States or by U.S. persons to Sudan without the need for individual export licenses.
Ambassador Booth stressed that the Sudanese people will benefit from U.S. communication products, which will facilitate interaction between the Sudanese people and the corporate world.
We believe that this move will make it easier for Sudanese to access these tools. It will promote freedom of speech and will help Sudanese citizens to communicate more easily with each other and allow them to be more connected digitally to the global economy. The revised rules will be effective tomorrow, Wednesday, February 18th.
The special envoy says the move by the Obama administration is in line with U.S. policy of promoting freedom of expression.
These regulatory changes today allow the exportation and re-exportation of certain specified personal communications hardware, software, and related services. Items like smartphones, satellite phones, security updates, and antivirus software are covered by these regulatory amendments. These changes are consistent with our commitment to promote freedom of expression through access to communications tools.
The Sudan government confiscated the operations of 13 newspapers on Monday. The Journalist Network in Sudan says the media environment is extremely hostile. Ambassador Booth says the Sudanese authorities have done very little to encourage freedom of expression.
Well, let me say, first of all, that this is a regulatory change that has been in the works for a long time. As you can see by the number of agencies on the call, this is a complicated matter. It is coming out just after the government in Sudan has confiscated, I believe, 12 to 14 newspaper runs. This is not a new practice on their part. It is one that we, of course, find to be of great concern.
That's Ambassador Donald Booth, U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He was speaking to reporters via telephone conference here in Washington today. South Sudan in Focus is funded by the Office of the Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. The first time the U.S. imposed sanctions on Sudan was in 1997. The United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei, or UNISFA, says a plane carrying 96 of its troops and four crew members was shot at last week while landing in Kadukli Airport in southern Kordofan. UNISFA has strongly condemned the attack, but says it is still trying to identify the shooters. VOA fellow Michael Atit has more from Washington.
UNISFA spokesman Daniel Adekara says the UN force is deeply concerned about the shooting.
The incident took place on the 13th of February at about 10:20 hours in the morning. Within this period, our troops from Ethiopia have been on rotation. Some who are finishing their tour of duty are going back to Ababa, and others coming to replace them. So we had the 11th Battalion, which was coming from Addis, and within the landing space of Kadugli Airport, they had a shot.
The plane was able to land safely, and all passengers and crew members are safe, Adekara says. He says UNISFA is still trying to determine who was behind the attack.
We've initiated an investigation, which is the process. This area has been experiencing some fighting between the Sudan Armed Forces and the SPLA North. So they are the group that are operating within this area. But we cannot at this point say exactly who possibly is responsible for this.
Earlier this month, a World Food Program aircraft was forced to land in an area controlled by SPLM North rebels, but was later released. Adekara says whoever shot at the UNISFA plane violated international law, but the attack has not stopped UNISFA from carrying out its mandate and supporting the peace process in the Abyei area, he says.
Within the Abyei box, we seem to be on top of the situation. We are dialoguing with the communities involved, with the two governments. For the Abyei box, we have ensured that the place is arm-free. There are no armed groups or armed elements operating within the box.
UNISFA flights to and from Kadugli have been suspended until further notice, Adekara says. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
From Abyei, we go to Upper Nile. A South Sudanese government official is accusing the rebels of launching fresh attacks on government positions in Upper Nile State yesterday and today. Lucy Pony has this story from Washington.
Just one day before peace talks are to resume between government and rebel negotiators in Addis Ababa, South Sudan's Minister of Defense, Kwal Manyang, accused rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar of shelling government forces from a location he identified as Wadakona in Upper Nile State, near the border with Sudan. Manyang says the shelling resulted in the
injury of many civilians and causing also movement of the civil population out of the town and destroying a number of houses. They have not yet been counted, the number of houses destroyed and the level of destruction in terms of loss of lives.
Manyang says the shelling was concentrated on the towns of Renk and Manyo, located at the northern edge of the oil-producing state.
These are rebel forces who are stationed at Manyo, at Wadakona, which is just exactly at the border, near the border of South Sudan and Sudan. This is where they have been mobilizing themselves and getting their own logistics and started moving and heavy machinery.
Peter Hoth, the Minister of Information for Upper Nile State, confirmed the reports. SPLM in opposition military spokesman Lul Roy Kong also confirms the clashes began yesterday and continued today, but denies the rebels attacked government positions.
The government troops attacked our positions at a place called a loop west of Kaki, and the intention was for them to advance on our positions in Wadakona, the administrative headquarters of Manyo County, and we resisted their advances. And while they were trying to advance on our positions, they received artillery fire support and mortar fire support from Rangwijis on the eastern bank, and in the process we ended up exchanging fires on both sides of the river. Our forces on the western bank of the river and the enemy forces on the eastern bank of the river.
Kong strongly denies the rebels are trying to capture new territory. He says more than 50 government soldiers were killed in yesterday's clashes, but there were no civilian casualties. Monday and Tuesday's shelling is the latest in a series of violations by both sides of the original January 2014 cessation of hostilities agreement. A renewal of that commitment was signed by the government and rebels last month in the Ethiopian capital. The two sides are scheduled to resume talks on Thursday in Addis to reach a comprehensive peace agreement aimed at ending the more than year-long conflict. Manyang says Riek Machar has been planning this most recent attack for a long time.
The rebel leader says he will only sign a peace agreement when he's in control of strategic towns. So So Reng is one of the strategic towns that he's targeting.
Manyang insists the 2 days of shelling is part of a series of attacks launched this month by the rebels in the strategic oil towns of Nasir and Bentiu. He says it's clear the rebels want to seize more oil-rich territory on the ground before any final deal is reached. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
That report was prepared by Waki Simon Wudu in Juba. South Sudan's 14-month-old conflict has affected government coffers and brought the country's parliamentary activities to a standstill, according to the Speaker of the National Legislative Assembly. Philip Thornaleu has more for VOA from Juba.
The Speaker, Manasseh Magog-Rundial, says the fighting has not only been devastating for the tens of thousands of South Sudanese driven from their homes by war, but also for the nation's coffers, which are now empty. He says the conflict has completely drained the country's main source of revenue.
This thing has actually curtailed everything. The resources are all stopped, and we are not operating well because of lack of resources. Salaries is given and other things, very petty, are being carried out. But we have a lot of challenges.
Rundial says the assembly can still buy things like fuel and paper so that specialized parliamentary committees like the Information Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee can continue doing their work. But he says Constituency Development Funds, or CDF, used for building things like schools and clinics in lawmakers' villages have been suspended.
CDF now is not operational. Since 2014, it is not being included in the budget because it cannot be met. The money we have there is so meager that it can really cannot meet the CDF.
Rundial says most schools in the countryside were built using CDF money. The CDF structure was introduced in 2009 to meet development gaps in the areas where there were no classrooms or dispensaries in then Southern Sudan before separation from Sudan in 2011. Rundial says the 14-month-old conflict must end if the development fast is to be revived. He says rebel fighters should cease attacking government positions and opposition leader Riek Machar should direct all reports toward peace talks in Ethiopia.
When the rebels attack the soldiers, also we are concerned. On both sides, there are our people. Killing here is not good for us. Killing there is not good for us. So we don't want to eliminate any of the two sides. There should be a tranquility in all fronts. There should be no killing and so forth.
Rundial says when the killing stops, oil fields could resume pumping more barrels per day and increase the government revenue, which accounts for approximately 98% of all revenue. While claiming there has been no misappropriation of funds in the assembly to cause the funding gap, Rundial warns high-ranking officials against using government funds for their own purposes.
When you are given an authority to be a minister, don't abuse your position. But if you abuse it, we will show to you that you are making an abuse of your office. But if you are going well, we will encourage you.
South Sudan National Legislative Assembly has never dismissed a member of the executive branch for abuse of office since its establishment. Rundial says if the conflict has not occurred, the government will have the money it needs for parliamentary activities. Rundial says he has called members of parliament from recess to deliberate a government proposal to amend the 2011 Transitional Constitution of South Sudan. The passage of the year is set to take place on Saturday. For BOA News, I am Philip Thornaleu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudanese elders from all the 10 states hold their own conference on how to resolve the fighting in the country. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where do you go to buy food, a local market or commercial supermarket?
Anyway, you can go to local market for many reasons. The most important one to go to local market is that in local market is almost not expensive. So you buy something that you need and then it cannot cost you a lot of money.
A local market, yeah, is where I go to get my foodstuff in the local market because things are basically more affordable than the supermarket and you get variety of whatever you want, so you're able to make choices.
For me as a student, it's according to the time when I have money or the time when I don't have money. Because on the time I have money, of course, I'm going to commercial market and buy those stuff. But there are time for local food so that it can push you.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions. From VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about HIV injected drugs. HIV infections are on the rise among people in Africa who inject illegal drugs. A new report recommends scaling up programs designed to prevent the spread of the AIDS virus among drug users. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The head of Harm Reduction International says unsafe injecting drug use is a major driver of HIV/AIDS worldwide.
Traditionally, we've seen regions such as Eurasia and Asia and the Middle East and North Africa sort of be epicenters of a lot of injecting drug use and a lot of unsafe injecting drug use. And so we see very high rates of HIV amongst people who inject drugs in those countries. But in recent years, researchers and community health organizations in a number of sub-Saharan African countries have also begun to document an increase.
Rick Lyne says there are new and emerging patterns of injecting drug use in such places as Tanzania, Zanzibar, Uganda, Senegal, and Kenya.
Of course, sub-Saharan Africa is a region of the world which has been disproportionately affected by HIV across the board, as we've known since the beginning of the epidemic. That has largely been driven by sexual transmission. So HIV transmission via injecting drug use in the region is something quite new. Our research would estimate that perhaps up to 1 million people are injecting drugs in various countries in that part of the world.
Lyne says the increase in injecting drug use in sub-Saharan Africa is connected to a change in drug trafficking routes. The drugs pass through the continent on their way to Western Europe. The Global State of Harm Reduction 2014 report calls for an increase in programs to help drug users. One such program is called OST, or Opioid Substitution Therapy.
Most people would probably be familiar with a medicine called methadone. Opioid substitution therapy is essentially a medical intervention whereby people who are dependent upon illicit opiates, most usually heroin, people who are injecting heroin, for example, can switch to drugs such as methadone, which are pharmaceutical prescription drugs administered by physicians or health clinics.
Methadone is taken orally. It's been in wide use in the United States, Western Europe, and Australia. Another way to help stop the spread of HIV among injecting drug users is the Needle or Syringe Exchange Program, or NSP. Lyne says it, too, has been in use for decades.
We know that the main risk of HIV transmission via injecting drug use is people sharing syringes. So one of the early interventions in what we call the harm reduction approach or HIV prevention approach was to set up programs whereby we have outreach workers going out and working with people who inject drugs and ensuring that if they're going to be injecting, that they're actually injecting with sterile equipment rather than sharing equipment.
He says needle exchange programs are widely credited with reducing HIV infection rates in Western Europe and Australia in the late 1980s. The Global State of Harm Reduction report says Malaysia, Iran, and Australia have seen the steepest increase in needle and syringe exchange programs. He says even though opioid substitution therapy and needle exchange programs are low cost, there's a big funding gap. He says UNAIDS estimates more than $2.3 billion is needed annually for HIV prevention among people who inject drugs. Lyne says only about $200 million of that is actually provided. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And now we take you back to Juba, where more than 700 South Sudanese elders from all 10 states are meeting in Juba today, the start of a two-day national summit. The elders want to highlight grassroots opinions about how to move toward final peace and reconciliation for all in the country. Mungume Devs Rakarinj reports from Juba.
Meeting organizers say the elders represent all 65 ethnicities which comprise South Sudan's population. Speaking at the opening, Central Equatoria State Governor Clement Yuani Konga said the people of South Sudan have suffered enough.
Considering the current suffering and destruction the country has undergone, the urgency of having peace now cannot be overemphasized. We are all aware that death, disease, hunger, broken families, displacement, destruction of property, disunity, economic depression, educational paralysis in some states have become the order of the day. And that is why we need peace now.
Konga repeated calls for the negotiators not to give opposition leader Riek Machar the post of deputy president as proposed by IGAD. But 64-year-old participant Arnold Dimamur from Mundre East in Western Equatoria disagrees.
People should not think about positions, but should think about peace. We want peace first before doing anything, because without peace, nothing can be done.
At least 10,000 people have been killed since the conflict began more than 14 months ago, and more than 2 million people have been displaced. Eunice Nyigo Adwang from Akobo's Jonglei State says all the suffering and death could have been avoided.
Tribalisms. We need to stop that one. We need to call ourselves Southern Sudanese without calling, I'm from this county, I'm from this country, I'm from this state. No, we all Southerners. If we are all Southerners, we should love each other.
Suba Samuel Manase is the information minister for the Central Equatoria State and a member of Governor's Caucus, which organized the conference. He says solutions must come from the people, not those who committed the atrocities.
We have come to realize that most of the attempts in search of peace and resolving the problem of South Sudan, all the attempts are not sustainable because it doesn't come from grassroots. All the ideas generated does not emanate from the grassroots, does not take into consideration the views and the feelings of the people at the grassroots. And in most cases, such peace, if it is implemented, it will definitely not have any direct implication with the situations or the realities in the ground.
The participants hope to produce a resolution from the summit, which they will present to negotiators in Addis Ababa. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Witnesses in northeastern Nigeria say Boko Haram militants have stormed a small city and burned much of it down. Fleeing residents say militants first raided Askira Uba in Borno State on Sunday, torching the home of the city's top official. They say the militants returned late yesterday and set fire to homes and public buildings. Able-bodied residents have fled the Borno state town in droves, leaving the sick and elderly behind. Reports say residents alerted the military but did not receive help. Provincial officials say a group of suicide bombers attacked a police station in eastern Afghanistan today, killing at least 22 officers and wounding 18 others. One attacker blew himself up at the gate of the headquarters in Pul-e-Alam, about 60 kilometers south of the capital, Kabul, according to a provincial government spokesman. At least one other bomber detonated his explosives inside the compound where officers had gathered to eat. Afghanistan's Taliban spokesman claimed responsibility for the attack. And finally, the UN Human Rights Chief is calling on Libyans to overcome crippling political divisions that have fractured the country and unite against extremism in the wake of the grisly revelation that Islamic State militants beheaded 21 Christian Egyptian workers there. The brutal murder of these men and the ghastly attempt to justify and glorify it in a video should be roundly condemned by everyone, according to a UN High Commissioner for Human Rights statement by Zeid al-Hussein. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, however, is turning to the UN to take the lead, asking the UN Security Council today to adopt a resolution calling for international military intervention in Libya. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Turning now to northeastern Nigeria, the insurgent group Boko Haram has distributed leaflets warning people to boycott the March 28th nationwide elections. But that is not the only threat to security. VOA's Anne Luke reports people are moving their families away from sites of possible tensions around the country and are preparing for unrest once results are announced.
From the Niger Delta to the far northeast, the pre-election period has become a time of migration for some Nigerians. VOA met several on the streets of Kaduna.
My wife has been pestering me for the past 3 months. Even today she called to say, are we ready to move?
Nobody wants to die for nothing. So I myself, I'm even planning to relocate to certain part of Kaduna where I will not be hearing sound of war, drums of crisis, burning of tires and tear gas and all those kind of things. I don't want to see all those rubbish.
If before the elections they are already tearing posters, you know, burning cars, injuring people, and are already being violent before the election, that anything can happen either during or after the elections.
Nigeria's last nationwide vote in 2011 was praised as more credible than any before it. But more than 1,000 people were killed, most of them during post-election violence, and mostly in Kaduna State, where politics sparked sectarian and communal tensions. The 2015 elections are shaping up to be the most hotly contested in Nigeria's democratic history. President Goodluck Jonathan and the ruling PDP party are facing a strong challenge from the opposition APC and its candidate, former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. Voters are nervous about the post-election period.
To take our time, we'll go and vote and we'll stay back and inside our houses and we'll look on how the election and the outcome of it will be. But certainly we have to go and vote.
Nigeria's police chief issued a statement this month trying to reassure voters and calling for them to stop relocating. But the pre-election incidents have been piling up. Party headquarters have been bombed or vandalized. Opposition supporters say they have been attacked in River State. A suicide bomber blew herself up in Gombe as President Goodluck Jonathan finished his rally there. Nigeria's National Human Rights Commission says at least 58 people have been killed in pre-election violence since December. Lagos, Kaduna, and River State, it says, have had the most incidents. Nigeria's Electoral Commission postponed the polls by 6 weeks to March 28th after security forces said they needed more time to fight Boko Haram in the northeast and ensure voting is safe. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Never to Share You with Somebody by Theresa Nyankol.
Never to share you with someone. I'm so glad to see you.
See you.
So glad to meet you. So great to meet you,
to meet you.
Really exciting to see you again, 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 and again,
again, again, and again.
Never to share you with somebody, never to share you with someone.
We have been listening to Teresa Nyankole with that song, Never to Share You with Somebody. Remember, these are not my words. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Belong to me, to myself, only for me.